You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintzenmeyer. My guest for episode 213 is Paul Chastain. He had his first solo release in 1985, and in the late 80s joined with Rick Menk to form a band that was initially called Choo Choo Train in Illinois. Then they moved to Rhode Island and it became Velvet Crush. He released six studio albums from 1991 through 2004. Right now you're hearing Hold Me Up from their second and most commercially successful album, Teenage Symphonies to God, 1994. Paul has since moved back to Illinois and has a project called The Small Square, releasing their first album in 2015 and now their second album in 2023, as Paul also plays as a longtime member of Matthew Sweet's band. Today we'll discuss Can't Let Go, parentheses, Oh Tommy, by The Small Square from their new album Ours and Others, California Incline by Velvet Crush from their last album Stereo Blues 2004, and Flower Field by Choo Choo Train from the Briar Rose EP 1988. We'll conclude by listening to SML from The Small Square, their 2015 self-titled album that's just been re-released. For more information, please see smallsquaremusic.com or actionmusic, that is with a K, actionmusic.bandcamp.com. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or support the effort at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic to get ad-free episodes. So I will have played a little bit of Hold Me Up by Velvet Crush from Teenage Symphonies to God, 1994, your second and biggest album, I guess.
Definitely the most well-known of our canon.
We're going to get pretty quickly to the new stuff. You were recording, what, a decade before even this early Velvet Crush thing, right? That you have a single from 85, I saw.
Doesn't seem like it, but yeah, it was. That's true.
Several albums of that, and then a pretty big gap. So is it just that you've been playing with Matthew Sweet and things between the breakup of Velvet Crush, which was 2005, something like that?
Yeah, our last record was 2004, I think, that we did. And we didn't really break up officially, but we just sort of stopped playing. And at that point, Jeffrey, our guitar player, had left the group. So it was just down to Rick Menk and myself. And We just stopped doing it for a little while. And yeah, I had some personal stuff that we both moved to different places and life stuff happened. And I did continue to play with Matthew Sweet. And I was working on my own stuff kind of slowly, but really I didn't do much outside music stuff.
So then The Small Square, you got an album 2015 and now a new one. So this is primarily a collaboration with the drummer John Richardson, is that right?
That's correct.
We're going to hear Can't Let Go, Oh Tommy, in full in a minute here. Can you give us an introduction to how is this band different? Where were you at with this second album? Why the big gap? I mean, the pandemic probably, but why this now and where are you at now?
John and I started. John is from Champaign, Illinois, where I'm also from. So we were in fledgling bands at the same time. So when I moved back from the East Coast after Velvet Crush stuff, I came back to the Midwest and just kind of started messing around, you know, writing songs with them. And then that kind of developed into, hey, why don't we make a record because we actually have enough songs going here. So that was our first record. We put that out on a small Japanese label and then eventually on our own label. And then we reissued it this last year on John's label that's affiliated with his studio. So that's how we put the record out some years later. Because I really wanted to get the record out. So I, instead of putting out different material, I thought, well, this is still new to anyone who hasn't heard it. So I want to put it out. And, you know, I kind of like the record. So I thought, let's do that. This is a song that I wrote actually a little bit before that time, and it was written originally for a demo for Sony Music Publishing. They asked me if I'd contribute a song to for a possible artist in Japan, where I live. The artist did not use that song, and so I just kind of put it on the side for a while. And when we were recording some stuff at John's studio one time, we had this fellow with his name, Walt Vincent, who's another multi-instrumentalist and producer who plays bass on this recording. Why don't we do this one? I really kind of like this song. And I was like, okay, well, I wasn't really thinking of doing that song. But so we did a version of it and I ended up liking that. And then tragically, my friend Tommy Keene, who's a good friend of all three of us that were there that day, passed away sometime later. And that inspired me to finish the lyrics up that I hadn't finished. And so that's why I named it with the Oh Tommy there, parenthetical phrase. So it's kind of about losing people and stuff. There's a bit of that on the record and in other songs as well. But that is what Can't Let Go is about.
I was thinking, wake me up when this is over. From a window.
Let's talk about the arrangement here. So very hard panning on the guitars. I mean, is this as the nominal bass player writer? I was also in a band in college where I was the bass player. The other songwriter was the drummer. But of course, we both played guitar and we wrote on guitar. It's just we wanted to get better guitarists than we were to actually play the parts live, or, you know, at least the lead parts. If Walt is playing the bass, I assume you're playing at least the main guitar.
I'm playing all the guitars.
Okay.
Walt does play bass and John plays drums. I don't think Walt played anything else on this one. He plays keyboards on another song, but yeah, I think I tracked it with acoustic guitar maybe, and then I switched out to electrics. And then I was really trying to change the sound just for my own sake to get it away from my demo that I had done that I didn't think fit our band. And I just happened upon playing it one day on a 12-string electric. So I used that for the second guitar, basically. Between that and the stuff that like Walt and John kind of straightened out the beat and stuff on it a little bit from what it was, that all was enough for me to go, okay, now, you know, I'm more on board with this now. And I really, you know, I like the song a lot better. So the confluence of all those three things that really sort of made me get behind the song. And now I, you know, it is one of my favorite ones. And my friend, Caleb Means, sings background vocals on it, I think, which was, and he's from Champaign as well. So that made it fun for me also. So we do like to get other people, invite them to the studio. There's a good bit of that on this record for sure. Walt plays on a couple songs, and we did a couple songs with kind of a big band, like a all at the same time, you know, Nashville kind of session. And our friends, this band Shoes, who are a 70s power pop band from Illinois, they appear on one song, the song called Open Up. So there's a lot of sort of mix and match stuff going on.
The very beginning of this song.
Is over.
no intro. Let's just go in. The drums come in a little later, have the bass come in a little later, but just the vocals and the guitar, it sounds very abrupt. Any thoughts about constructing that particular intro?
You know, I'm not even sure that's how we started. I think there was a guitar in the beginning of it originally, like a few bars of it. I think at one point I just thought, you know what, I want to come in right on the vocal. So it was a conscious decision. I don't remember how the beginning was, to be honest. Maybe just started with the guitar that would have been right before that vocal, like the downbeat of it or something. But I decided just to have the vocal. I thought that was like, I hadn't done it before. So I thought, like, I'll just do that. Up is just like for the moment, you know, when I'm mixing it, I'm like, well, let's try that one, you know, and see what happens.
And are these purely musical decisions or are these kind of trying to reflect a little bit of what you're saying in the lyrics, that, you know, you've got whispers and dreams and things, and which it's not a whispery, dreamy song at all. It seems more just that these are purely musical decisions.
Yeah, I think it was more musical, just how it hit me. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a big deal to me that it, whether it started with a guitar or not, but I thought at one point, maybe it'd be cool to just have it clean coming in right to the point, because I almost never have the lyrics start right away, you know, and I do my formula of my songs that it seemed to happen. So I don't know. I think it was just like a thought, you know, an idea, because there's like, you know, hundreds of ideas that happens, you know, it stuck. So I just left it. But I don't think it has, to me, it didn't have anything to do with the sort of lyrics or the delivery of that.
Let me play a little bit of the second verse. You know, it starts, okay, this is a nice accompanying, but it sort of does extra noodling. I felt like it's taking up a lot more space than I would expect, given that it's just sort of the background.
The 12 string's not even in until that. It enters on the second.
Okay.
Pair. And then I just, yeah, I kind of used it as, I don't know, I jangle it a bit, and then I liked the sound of it. Because the other one was just playing real tight rhythm, like, you know, like with the drums kind of, and I thought, there was a little space I can fill up, so, and I thought that built, I liked the way it built into the louder, you know, the chorus part after. So I hadn't heard the 12 string on the song this whole time. Like when we were playing it with Walt and stuff, I hadn't thought of that yet. So I was really kind of just enjoying the 12 string sound because I'm a fan, you know, I'm a huge Birds fan and all that stuff. So I thought this sounds cool. So I'm going to leave it in there.
In keeping with that, we're not going to have an intro. It gets to the chorus very fast, 17 seconds in. And then we're already transitioning with the second line ready to launch, you know, with your new chords over a long, long time ago. How do you think about the energy levels? I saw different courses, you're adding more and more harmonies. How are you gauging, like, how beautiful and bright, given that you're just pulling this punch out right at 17 seconds in, how do you moderate that so you have enough juice left for the rest?
I think I always think about a lot, most of the songs, I try and sort of ramp them up, mm-hmm. either to sort of an apex, you know, in the middle of the song or clear to the end of the song. Like on some of the songs do that. And I just kind of feel it, how it feels like it should be to me, you know, just my sensibility. So it, I'm sure people don't agree. John probably doesn't agree sometimes also. I just build it. I create a song for him and then kind of try to make the emotional arc of it work from how I feel about it or what I think. So, and I thought the chorus could be kind of bigger. So I thought it's okay to ramp this into that.
So around 57 seconds in, when the second verse, you don't want to have that as short. So we're going to add sort of a delaying tactic. We're going to add a pre-chorus, this walking down. Here it is. Before we could recover, before another, then another, nothing more. Just the fact that the whole thing is a steady walk down, but then for the last line, we're going to do a faster walk down. You know, so it's an escalator inside an escalator.
A variation of the B verse. I guess it only happens those two times, but the first one was like the as written kind of B verse. And that one, yeah, I wanted a little more time before the chorus to make it kind of like, this is really the chorus instead of the first one happens, but you know what I mean? It's kind of like a smaller chorus in a way. So I just felt like I wanted a little more space in there somehow. And I had something to say, so I expanded that out to explain it. Yeah, that's a good description though. You're thinking of things I probably didn't think of when you're, but it's very interesting.
Well, and then, you know, as the walk down is happening in the chords that you launch in the vocals, I hear your voice again and feel you. And again, you said you finished these lyrics later after the death of Tommy. Like, did you even have in mind that this is talking to dead people? Or I guess in this case, you can physically listen to another musician you know, you can hear their voice in a very literal way.
Well, originally the song, I had the song title for that demo thing that I was talking about. It wasn't mandatory that I wrote lyrics. In fact, the artist would want to probably write their own lyrics. What I did was I had a chorus, which I sang in English, and then I just had like humming melody, which was not exactly that melody that is on the record now. And so I had the chorus the whole time, and I thought, well, I'll keep that. But it was more like a relationship, can't let go. So after applying the, you know, the loss of our dear friend, that took on a different meaning. And then that's really, I think, what turned around so I could actually finish the lyric to have some meaning for me.
So how strong is your Japanese? Have you written lyrics in Japanese?
Not quite yet.
I can see the temptation that you wisely resisted of, if you're going to be writing la-da-da-da-da because somebody else is going to write the lyrics, just do fake Japanese.
The main idea I have of it is the chorus so that, you know, they can get the flavor of it. And I don't know how far it got in the process, but that's okay. You know, you take a shot.
Was this unusual for you to have the music completely first with, I'm not even going to write the lyrics, or are you normally a lyrics first, you know, big notebook of stuff that you then pull out at opportune times kind of guy?
It's pretty normal. I always have the music first. I might start with a, like this, probably started like that, like just with a, like a little kernel of an idea, you know, word idea, a phrase or something that indicates the part of the song I thought of first. This one happened a little differently, but it generally it's song first and then I apply the lyrics. I finish the lyric later. And those do take me a bit of time to work through a lot of times. The music is faster to get, I think.
I have written down here that this is officially a co-write with you and John and Walt. Is that right? Or is that, that's just the way you're doing publishing because you're nice?
More the latter. First of all, the guys that contribute to our record, we, for the most part, do not pay them anything. And so Walt just says, yeah, let's play, let's do it, because he likes to do it, you know? And so one of my thank yous is that if they really contributed to the thing, which he did, definitely, yeah, I include them a writer's share of the, and a credit on there, because I don't know if they ever get anything from it, but they get something. That's my little sort of thank you to them. Because, you know, the players, we like them to come in and we don't really tell them what to do usually. You know, we don't really say, now here's what we were thinking this. We just say, like, here's the song and you're going to play this instrument on it. And what do you think? You know, sometimes we do have a specific part and we need a guitar person to come in and do a little thing or something. Then we're more specific. But generally, we get the person and we let them kind of choose the song. And we have like demos and we play them and they go, okay, let's work on this one. And that's exactly what happened. And I feel like doing that, they do the thing that they do and they contribute something to the song that is something I can't think of or John can't think of, you know, so they're creating a thing. So I think they kind of do deserve credit for doing that. No, they didn't write the music, the chords, and they didn't write the lyrics, but that doesn't mean there's not other large contributions happening.
Yeah, I guess it's different depending on the status of the money. I kept asking another guest who was sort of runs a Texas country swing band, you know, wow, this violinist is really doing a lot of stuff. Like, did he get publishing for that? Like, he was played to pay the fiddle.
That's valid too. I mean, it depends on what you're doing. But for us, in our way, it's all just like, we get friends. Everyone plays on it as a friend, you know, so, and they're just doing it out of niceness and because they like to play music and maybe they like that music that they're doing. So it's all like a favor. So I feel a little bit beholden to them.
So when the harmonies kick in more and more, with me, sort of harmonies is the exception. Maybe I'll get somebody to come in and try whatever you want. But for the most part, as a guy who thinks in harmonies, like I have pretty definite ideas. And can you just kind of sing the part that I just did? Or, you know, I don't know what's your thought on putting together something orchestrated sounding like this.
Well, I mean, I don't have any method for doing it. I think on this one, though, I did have an idea and I probably sang it on there. And then I need more than this, more than I'm able to do. And I need somebody that can sing a little higher. And I think it would sound cool to have a different thing blending, not just me and me. I felt like that helped kind of push the lead vocal more. So it's more independent, you know, like it's not me, you know, that's me. And the other thing, Caleb's got a little bit higher voice and he can sing strong and high. So I thought I'll ask him if he would do it. And you know, he just did it like in a few minutes. So it wasn't any big thing for him. So, and I like the way that sounded. And I had sung with him before and I knew that our voices could blend. So in this case, that's how we did it. A lot of times I just do the harmony stuff because I'm just trying to finish the song by myself. And
it's so much easier.
But in that case, I was actually here in Champaign where I am today. I was here and I thought, man, I could just go out to Caleb's studio if he'll agree to do it. And that's exactly what I did. And, you know, I took the stuff out there and said, hey, can you do something on this? And he's like, yeah. So, you know, again, as a favor to me.
But then you felt like your guitar stuff was enough, you know, that you didn't need an extra dimension out of that from another person. That's just this particular song. That's the way it happened to roll out, or that was your...
Both. I mean, I felt like it was after I put the 12 string on that, that, as you said, did fill up a lot of the area, a lot of the space. So I didn't really feel like it needed another thing to happen. And also that was me finishing the song out and I was alone. And I thought I could send this off to somebody if I could think of it. But I felt like, you know, it was okay. You know, the first song in the record, the 23rd, that song I had like finished and there was no, that second guitar part was not on there. I was like, I like it, but it's not something. It's not happening. And so then I thought, I'm going to call my friend, John Mormon, in San Francisco, and ask him if he'd take a listen to this and if he has any ideas that he would put on. And I sent it to him. He said, yeah, send it on. And he did it and sent it back a couple days later. And his part was like so perfect, but I would have never thought of it kind of thing. I just put it in the track, basically. I didn't edit it or do anything. I just sort of stuck it in there because he just got it. I was like, okay, now I got something. And, you know, I didn't know it was missing that for quite a while. And then, you know, so it does work all the different ways.
Well, yeah, you said you, even when you're in person with somebody, you're not telling them what to do necessarily. Are you just using the tyranny of the mix to decide whether that particular lick is in that? You don't have to confront anybody. You just silently remove the parts you don't like or...
You know, when we're tracking the stuff at John's, even with another person, we don't always know where the song's going. You know, we have like a really skeletal demo, or maybe there wasn't even finished. Some songs get finished in the studio, you know, like we work on it. And so I may not know exactly where it's going to go. And then I start kind of getting a mix together and getting a feel for it. And then I get an idea like, oh, I think it can do this. I know a direction. And sometimes some of the things that somebody played might not go with that idea, but everything else does. So in that case, I trim some stuff out or do whatever it takes at that point. But the fact that they played on the thing and made it all come together in the first place was still hugely important to getting to that point. So even though it seems, you know, I feel bad about trimming parts out, the genesis of that was still important that they played, and it got me to where I wanted, you know, needed to be later. So it still played a very important role, just not me, you know, maybe not an audible one in the end, but generally I don't want to cut people's stuff out of the song.
As another one of my guests said to me, you can lose friendships over that stuff. You ask somebody to do a part and then you don't use any of it, or, you know.
You know, some of the guys that played on it are like guys that do a lot of session work. And so they seem to have sort of less visible ego about that sort of thing. And they understand, you know, they do that all the time. So they're like, here's my stuff. And then you can do whatever you want. And, you know, if I'm really going to not that kind of a person, I would say, you know, I might not use this part on here, or I might just use part of this or whatever. But everyone's pretty cool about it, you know, because at the end of the day, people want to help make a cool thing.
You're not Steely Dan of like, let's get five people to do the guitar solo and decide which one, make them compete.
But that's very interesting. I was watching those a while back, the YouTube things of all the different guitar players, and they all played like amazing stuff. How you feel about it that day, you're like, this one's doing it for me, you know, or this one's great, but I don't know, you know, like I can understand that part of it, but just having the sort of balls and the money and time to get all the, like, we got six great supersonic guitar players to play on this, and now we're going to choose.
I'm sure if I had that, I would put little bits of each of them. I can't resist using some portion.
Well, I think in some cases, it seemed to be like they maybe gave a little bit of instruction and then they didn't like that or something, you know, like kind of like this. And then when they did kind of like that, they thought, oh yeah, maybe that's not what I was, you know, sometimes when you get it out of your head, it doesn't line up how you thought it would. And that's, so I'm sure that happens. But man, all those guys played really amazing stuff. That was pretty incredible.
Before we move on for this song, the ultimate DIY thing, the harmonica solo. Let me play a little bit of that. So it's these background, like fireworks shooting off. That's what most interests me about this.
I'm not sure how I got the harmonica involved there. I don't know. It's kind of weird, actually. I remember thinking there's like a synthesizer thing going on in there all over the place, kind of like Roxy Music sort of synthesizer stuff happening. And then once I got that in, I thought it needs something a little more, it needs a melody thing that's a little more direct and simple. to kind of tie it all together, because there was like stuff going on.
Oh, so you had the fireworks, like that was first, and then
it just didn't have enough like focus or something, you know. And I don't know how I came up with harmonica, except that I had one, because I don't play, you know, I'm not like a harmonica player, but
you can punch in and play it for three measures.
Yeah, I tried it. You know, harmonicas sound like a keyboard instrument, sort of, like an organ or something. So I thought, oh yeah, that sounds pretty cool. But really, when I think of it now, it seems kind of odd that I did that. I don't know.
All right, let's get the second song out there. California Incline from Velvet Crush, from your last album, Stereo Blues. The last gasp of this band. It was supposed to be, according to something I read, a return to form. The previous album was more mellow songs. Now we're going to balls out rock again. This is not the greatest example of the balls out rock on there, but it's a nice solid pop song. But it is 5 minutes. It's not the 2 minutes.
The previous album, I think, was probably Soft Sounds. And that record was actually, I started it as being like a solo record. So there's a lot of stuff that's like acoustic stuff and stuff that I had just done in my little studio room. And I was going to eventually do a solo record with it. And then we turned it into Velvet Crushing. So it was not really a band record. But on Stereo Blues, we did that record back here in Champaign, Illinois, with our friend Adam Schmidt, who is a singer-songwriter and engineer and producer guy, multi-instrumentalist. We got this one phase of the record where we thought, let's get some of the guys. Rick Mank and I used to both live here, and we were in some of those bands that put out little singles while we were here. So he lived here for a short time. He's not from here. But while we were here, during our tenure, there were these other bands around, and we decided to ask a couple of people from bands that we liked from that time if they would join us on this song. So those are guitar player Nick Rudd, who was in a band called Turning Curious, and a guy on keyboards and harmony vocals, this guy named Bob Kimball, who was in a band called Weird Summer. And both of those bands were actually pretty great back in the day. So we asked them both to come in, and we recorded kind of live-ish with them, and then had Nick do a crazy freak-out solo, kind of a la Tom Verlaine or something. I guess we were going for that kind of a vibe a little bit. So the song was kind of free form, and we just kind of made the form of it up right there, I think. You know, like I had the basic parts of it. It was my chords and everything, and I wrote the words. But I think once we got Nick in there, we just decided we'll do a long section here and we'll do this, you know, like the form was just arranged on the spot. And then we tried to play that, you know, after we decided it. So, and Nick's pretty great. He was a pretty great guitar player and could just kind of do stuff. So we did a few takes of that with him, just doing freak out stuff. And that's what it became. And then a nice sweet from Bob Kimball. That was cool.
Coming off a
Is the false start an essential part of the song? Because it sounds like you actually start playing a different song.
Nick was playing the guitar, I can hear in the background, I think, if I remember correctly. And then I think it was between takes. That probably wasn't the first take that we did of it. And so we probably said, let's do another one right away or something. And he was still going over the chords because those guys just learned the song like then, you know. So I think that's probably what it was. We were tracking it partially live, the basic part. I think we did, because I played bass. So yeah, we were probably doing the three of us live as we went, or Bob might have been playing a keyboard. I think we did it all live actually somehow. So yeah, I think it was just in between takes, and you can decide yourself if that's important. We like that kind of stuff, the leave stuff on the beginning, you know, where you hear talking. I always like that in records.
I mean, you got, again, kind of hard panned stereo guitars here, but the one on the right is the fact that this is all improvised, you know, that he's just learned the song right there. I mean, like, he runs in fact, at 27 seconds, he throws in a note that sounds like a wrong note for the key that you're in. Do you know what I
mean? Yeah.
Nice little major thing where it's not supposed to be. I mean, was that just fortuitous that he sort of screwed up? But it sounds really great.
That rhythm guitar part was the one we tracked, and that was just how it happened, and we just didn't worry about it. It's an outside note is what we call it.
Yes. Okay, so that makes more sense, that he was doing the more conservative part when you actually played it with him.
And then he overdubbed a few of those, but we didn't do too many of those freak out ones, because it just, you know, he just like went for it, and then he couldn't really do too many of them. He was like, okay, I can maybe do another. But he just kind of like let it go, let it hang out. And we were encouraging him, and that's what happened. But yeah, that was just a little one of those things. And we left it. We left in the weird note.
I briefly panicked this morning. Wait, did I suggest a song that Rick actually sings lead on? Because, and then I went and listened to some of his solo album. Like, no, okay. He sounds more Chris Stamey-ish, a little more nasal than I'm hearing here. But this is definitely not the same voice from you that we heard on most of your stuff. It's more withdrawn, sedate. I don't know. Do you know what was going on with your voice during this for this song?
I just sang it kind of quieter instead of yelling it like I do on a lot of the other stuff. And I don't know why. That's just how I did it. I don't remember having a big thing about it or anything, but I just felt like singing it like that, I guess. I don't know. Good question.
Any thought on your using the bass here? Just that you're playing kind of up on the neck, you're playing half notes. This, if a keyboard just came in, is doing little pads, that you're using your bass like that, as opposed to holding the rhythm down.
I was thinking I'd just kind of save it until the chorus happened more. You know, like I'd be up high, kind of out of the way. And then, because Nick's guitar part was really rhythmic kind of feeling. So I thought maybe I can just let it carry. Just trying it. I might not do it the same way if we had done it another day or something, but I kind of constructed it that way where I'm, yeah, it was up high and you can't even tell if I'm playing or not because it sounds like part of the guitars or something. And then I thought once the chorus comes in, I'll be down where I should be and stabilize that.
The pre-chorus is just one line, a transition. And then here we're opening up with this beautiful Monkees-esque sort of, you know, really, really bright. Are we going to use the pre-chorus to cook it, make it seethe longer? And then, no, we're just getting right there, at least with this one.
I feel like the verses were kind of winding enough that you were already ready for it, you know? They kind of go on a little bit and they're slower and
sure,
or lazier kind of, and then that one comes in as more like the march or something. It's almost not like a pre-chorus. It's almost just gone before you know it. I just wanted to slam into it.
Sure. And then when it gets into that bright part, so this is the second song, you know, we had a nice bright chorus in the last one. How are you determining how cheesy you let it get? Like, if I were doing this, I might even add some claps or something, you know, because it's that kind of, I said, Monkees-esque, you know, that
yeah,
suggests that, but it certainly doesn't need that. Like, it's plenty cheery without really cheesing up the arrangement, but throwing in a keyboard, throwing in.
A lot of times worry about getting it too saccharine or too sweet on parts. I like to get there, but not overdo it. But the thing about this song was we were going for more of just kind of a live-ish thing. So we didn't want to do a ton of overdubs and stuff like that on it. Extra little niceties that you know, like there is a tambourine on it. I think Rick played a tambourine, but we just didn't want to put a lot of stuff on because we wanted to have more of a live-ish feel with, you know, with these other two musicians and just like see, like a let's see what happens kind of feel instead of carefully crafted or tailored, you know, to it like sometimes you do.
Well, yeah. And just the fact that it is the length that it is, seems just because you wanted to let the guitars screw around a little bit. Like, it's not that it was, you were over orchestrating. This is not a Beach Boys.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a different vibe. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's not the kind of thing we usually do, that having a guitar, you know, thing like that on it. But it's just what we, it just sort of happened with the players that we chose to do. And I remember at the time there was some review. It was really bad. The guy really didn't like it. And he thought the guitar is, sounds like you're crapping on the neck of a guitar or something like that. It's like, really? I thought it was very closed-minded of him. But that's not our normal fare, but we were trying to see what happens. Like, just with Small Square, you get people to come and play, and then that might open up an avenue of a thing that isn't really your normal sort of natural course because of the thing that they can do and they even maybe gravitate towards. So you can go, hey, what if we did like that? Kind of combining their specialty or a thing that they're really good at and bring it into your world. And that's pretty fun to do, you know? Sometimes you just get sick of yourself, basically, you know?
Sure. Well, within the last year, I talked to Ivan Julian, another Matthew Sweet collaborator, who said, oh yeah, Matthew's process is that he'll record these very pristine little parts and then invite him or Quine or one of the other guitarists to poo-poo all over it. Is how
he's right. Ivan, yeah, he's been making the rounds, and I've been happy to hear him on some of these podcasts. Ivan and I go way back in the Matthew Sweet band and spend a lot of time together. And he's right on point with that, because Matthew's songs, while they're not all upbeat and cheery, they are very melodic. And sometimes it seems like they're happier songs than what the lyrics are saying. But the chords of them are big pop chords. And then he gets these scientist guitar players to come and do crazy stuff. And I think that works.
Let me play some in this gap right before the solo. You're having this sustained harmonic from the guitar and then this little keyboard that hasn't been in the rest of the song. Do you remember, like, well, why do we need a thing there? Well, who's doing that?
Bob Kimball was playing, and I think it is going in the song, but we weren't really featuring it. It was just kind of back in the background. I think it plays in places that you can't really tell, but we just stopped playing there so you could hear the keyboard there. And that's kind of where Nick enters with his lead, and that's what the feedback is, just him starting to get going on that. That arrangement, we just made it up, so we didn't have an idea what would go in there. So we thought, well, we'll just see what happens when we get there. And that's what happened, you know?
Yeah. And when you have the nice open section that, well, apparently it was a guitar solo, but the guitar solo was overdubbed, right? So you didn't even know that you were reacting to some rhythms, that dynamics just between the rhythm section there, you know, that you give Rick room to then do some spazzy drum fills, which I guess is not his norm, right? If you have very tightly constructed, often 2-minute songs, he doesn't get to really show off.
Especially, you know, this record, at one point, I remember him saying, like, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do fills. It was probably post this song or pre this song, and you know, but he wasn't doing a lot of stuff at that time because he just was like thinking, I don't feel like doing fills. In fact, there's a song on the record where he doesn't do any fills at all. So yeah, it just gave some space. But like you said, it's very true. We didn't know. We weren't playing with the lead there. We were just like imagining that something would be here. And we were like, we'll go, you know, 8 bars or whatever. We just had it mapped out like that. So, you know, just scheduled, but we didn't know. We weren't reacting to it. We had to, like, allow for it, you know?
Yeah, it's almost like a Velvet Underground song that you, it's just one chord for this long time, and it just, you could have whatever crunchy noises you want. At 4:30, the bass actually goes to a new note. Let me play that. But apparently you are going between 2 notes at that point.
I was droning the whole solo pretty much.
Uh-huh.
I was just staying out of the way on that one, just letting it happen.
When Cynthia came to TurboTax, she had just launched her new side gig, a true crime podcast.
I'm a first-rate detective with a golden voice.
As her TurboTax expert, I made her second income count by guaranteeing 100% accurate filing and her maximum refund.
What did she do with that refund? Find out next week.
Switch to Intuit TurboTax and make your moves count. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees. Experts only available with TurboTax Live.
All right. Well, so a very nice jammy sort of tune after the first one. Let's get the third one out there, going way back. And this is, talk about Saccharin. I mean, it's from 1988, Flower Field by what was then called Choo Choo Train from the Briar Rose EP, but still You and Rick, now available on the Hey Wimpus early recordings of Chastain and Menk record. Give us some background of these sessions and where you're at with this. Again, it's 88, but it really sounds like about 83.
Yeah, well, it was inspired by more like, you know, like Sarah Records kind of stuff, I think, and that kind of thing that we were into, those British labels with the twee bands and the sort of psychedelic-y bands and things like that. And then, you know, a bunch of other stuff. But that was an early song that I wrote. We just went and tracked some songs one day at a local studio here in Champaign, Illinois. That was one of them we did. We did a Matthew Sweet song, and we did that one and a few others. And our friend, I think that's the ones where our friend Jeff Merritt, who runs Parasol Records for all these many years, actually paid for us to go into the studio and do this. So it was just a song we had, you know, and I really think we were probably, like I said, influenced by that British stuff a lot, like Sarah Records in particular, just making a pop song. It's pretty twee. I mean, I sort of liked it, though. I hadn't listened to it until I decided to do it for this thing. And I thought, oh, yeah, it's not so bad. Some of them make me cringe. This one doesn't necessarily make me cringe. I thought it's okay in concept.
I had not actually heard the term wimp rock that you reference in the liner notes and, you know, in the description on Bandcamp for this and calling it Hey Wimpus. Maybe this is not the best. This song is not the best example of that. I mean, it has these little Koto keyboard sounds that are, you know, guitar
like. That was like a really cheap little Casio keyboard that I had. And I used to make beats on it and I'd write the demos to that and stuff. But it was just very early. We didn't know really what we were doing. And we just kind of did something that sounded kind of like my demo, only with real drums on it. And that part was probably on my demo. I don't remember. You know, I used to have like a little 4-track cassette recorder that I do demos on. We would just try stuff because we weren't so fully developed and we had influences and things, but I don't remember thinking we're trying to be exactly like this or that or the other. We just were doing the songs that we came up with at that time. It was so much more innocent then, Mark.
All right. So very nice. Is that an actual 12 string or is that?
I think it's just a 6-string, but, you know, delay or something on it. I don't remember, to be honest, what guitar I played, but.
Sure.
Might have been my guitar, might have not been my guitar.
So, you know, I guess I didn't even really address this. It sounds like both this and the previous song are not really. Was everything labeled a co-write for a while with you and Rick? That was just the Lennon and McCartney way that you were doing it? Or is it? Because I know some of the records in the credits that I was seeing, they were all labeled like that. Even ones that probably clearly you just wrote or he just.
Definitely for Velvet Crush, we did a thing and then a two-way thing when it was just the two of us. I don't remember when we started it. Probably the earlier ones would really reflect that we both wrote them together. If you see solo credits and double, then the double ones would not like that. But once I really only remember making the decision about that once we formed Velvet Crush with Jeffrey Underhill and we decided to just do a three-way split and whoever wrote more of the song got the extra percentage, you know, from the 33 that all this work that we do and have to do, you know, that we should all have a piece of the songs because we don't all write every song. We did all contribute to songs.
It is a weird system of, you know, let's divide equally between the writer and the performers when the writer could be, yeah, I spent a half an hour doing this at some point and now it takes us months developing this on the road or getting it down. And
in the early days, and not so much later records, but the first Velvet Crush record, there's a few songs on there that I brought in that were just like, you know, we used them because we had them. But most of the songs in that record, we were in the space just jamming, blasting those things out. And so they were really very collaborative. You know, like somebody would come in with the core idea. Any one of the three of us would have an idea about something, a melody or a thing, and then we'd fit that in or exclude it or whatever. And those were, a lot of those songs were really super collaborative. And that's when we came up with, once we had to decide about publishing, like for Teenage Symphonies, that's sort of when we came up with that. Like, well, look, we all collaborate on this stuff. And there's all these other jobs that have to be done also, not just songwriting. So let's just split it every, you know, three ways. And it did start out that way. It really was like, oh, this is Rick's idea. We're going to flesh that out today. Oh, Jeffrey has a lick we're going to work on. You know, I have a thing here. You know, that's really how it was. It got to be less that way as the records went on because people would kind of write on their own a bit more. Everybody would still have suggestions if they had them. It was always open, but just didn't happen quite as much. The first one was like, really, that's one thing I love about that record that I remember is that it's so collaborative. The feeling of making those songs, they just would come out of one little idea and then three people chiming in and making this thing that none of the three of us would have thought of on our own. And that made it really band-like to me. And I really liked that. That was cool.
So was it a little journey to get to the attitude towards your lyrics that you were describing before of lyrics are coming later? They're not the main thing that, I mean, this one has the feel. Maybe it's a little more twee. Can we walk in the pastel light through the dawn of the winter? Like 18 with his notebook kind of thing.
Yeah. But with the Velvet Crush stuff, I wrote most of the lyrics for those songs. Sometimes somebody would come on in with a phrase or the title or something. And maybe there's a couple things where those guys wrote lyrics too. But I would generally either write the lyric or finish the lyric or something like that. But they would always come after the music was happening. Then I fit words into it, you know, or I get inspired by the sound. Especially on a co-write, it wasn't like I had an emotional idea, you know, for words. And so on those, sort of more inspired by what we made, by the sound of it and the feeling of that, and then go, okay, I can get behind this and figure out something that I think goes with it. It was more like that.
In the cases where Rick came up with the lyrics, would that be more likely the ones that he is going to sing? Or were you sort of by default, I'm going to the lead singer after a certain point, at least?
Yeah, anything he sang on was his, either a cover song or his, mainly his lyric, or maybe completely his lyric. Sometimes I would, I don't remember, but in the early days I would fill in, like he said, I don't have this second verse or something, you know, whatever. And I would, maybe I'd suggest something, but he, when he sings it, it's either one, a cover song that he chose, or he wrote that lyric, I would say.
So it sounds like if you did help him, it was by invitation, not because I'm the lyricist and I'm good at this. I'm just saying this because I've done this to other people, songwriters in the band. Like, I feel good about my lyrics. And so when you write lyrics, I'm going to be just as critical of them as I would be of mine and try to fix them for, and that never goes over well. So I did get over that.
We were very conscious of trying to just make sure everyone understood that any criticism or any suggestion or anything like that was, you know, not leveled at the person. And it was in the spirit of, we're just trying to create some music here. that's the spirit it should always be in. So whenever anybody says anything, even if it sounds like they might be, you know, pissed off at you or whatever, it's just that we're all trying to get to this one goal. So we all try to keep that in mind, you know, and I think that helped a lot, because sometimes it can get, you know, pretty tense doing stuff or saying like, oh, your part sucks or whatever, you know, but keeping in mind, if you really can keep that goal in mind and not let everybody's sort of feelings get hurt, then that's what we tried to do and succeeded most of the time, I think.
Well, and it probably helps just having a pretty eclectic, wide tastes that you can,
yeah,
lyrically, I mean, there are certain people that I've been in bands with that if I presented something about, you know, you and I in the flower field and the future is tapping me on my shoulder, that they would have been like, that doesn't meet a certain level of, I guess this is back to the Hey Wimpus thing, of masculinity or something. That's too Beach Boys. It's too twee or something, such that this is, it's so it's almost more like, what front do we want to present to the audience? Like, if you're writing about Dungeons and Dragons stuff, like maybe we shouldn't have that in this song, you know?
If I had written something that seemed to not go along with the thing we were trying to do and it struck Rick the wrong way, he would have said it. And I would have allowed him to say, I would have said, I would have welcomed him saying something like that. And so I think the thing about when Rick and I started working together, we realized that we were really sort of on the same page about a lot of stuff. And that's why we were working together. That's why we started working together. So a lot of that stuff didn't get talked about because it just was okay. You know what I mean? But still, if I would have written a Dungeons and Dragons thing, he might not have enjoyed that. Trying to do this sort of twee thing that we were doing, he probably said, that may not be the best way to go, because he would speak his mind, you know? So
it still sounds like your communication powers for, wait, were you 19 or 20? When were you doing this around?
Well, 80s, you know?
Okay. Were you out of college or were you?
Yeah.
All right. So there's already some maturity by that point, you know, dealing with other.
We're a little bit late bloomerish. But the reason we got together in the first place was I was living in Champaign and I had a band that was my first band was kind of breaking up. And I wanted to do some recordings before and after that happened. And I heard these guys at this local record store called The Pop Shop played this song, this album, this EP, I guess it was, by this band called The Reverbs, which was Rick's band that he had. And they got released on a major label, I believe, of some kind. And I heard that and I said, oh my God, this is really cool. Who did this? I want to go to that studio. Well, it's in Chicago. And I called the guy, Michael Freeman, who ran the studio, and he recorded that record with Rick. I talked to him for a little bit and he said, okay, first of all, you have to meet my friend Rick, because you guys are like saying the same stuff to me. It's essential that you meet him. You're really on the same page. So he arranged, you know, to have us meet somewhere. And he was exactly right, because we didn't know each other, you know, at that point. But once we started playing, we had similar, you know, likes and dislikes. And we both wanted to make songs and we were, you know, the same age. And so
you don't want to just get on stage and jam. You want to make songs?
Just jam. That's what I always wanted to do. That's what I still want to do. That's my thing. I like to do that. A couple days ago, I'm a little bit dragged out because I just got back from a little mini Matthew Sweet tour that we had did the first time in for like 5 years. So it was a little bit tiring in the Midwest in February.
All right. Well, I'm not going to make you sit closely at the particular synth riffs in the middle of this. I think we can skip over that. I do like the fact that at the end, actual sleigh bells come out and that you got this repeating riff sort of thing.
Yeah. You know what? Speaking of synthesizers, that little keyboard was like so far from what I'd call it actually a synthesizer. It was like a toy thing, if I remember. They were pretty cheap and you could get them like a Casio or something.
Yeah.
And that's what it sounds like actually too.
I have the Casio that I used in high school behind me. Not that it gets used for anything more than a trigger, but they were okay with percussion-y sounds, with chimes. It's a CC5000.
Yeah. Those were the days.
All right. To close out here, let's introduce the last song. We're going to play just something from the previous Small Square release, 2015's the self-titled album, SML, Save My Life. I just picked this. I felt like I hadn't heard a lot of Velvet Crush before, but I'm such a big Birds, Big Star, Sloan, you know, that kind of jangle pop stuff that, you know, this was just in my wheelhouse. And this song in particular really had that. We haven't had an actual ballad in our plate yet today. And I just thought this just really encapsulates that Bad Finger feel. Any thoughts about, again, this record and where you're at with this song before we say goodbye here?
The first Small Square record was kind of pulled together from a lot of older stuff and some newer stuff that it had done. So this is one of the older ones. So the beginnings of this song were probably while Velvet Crush may have still been together, you know, the very early beginnings of that song. And this was the beginning of a demo. And then I reworked it. I used some of the original tracks and added some stuff like drums to do the small square thing. But I always kind of had a soft spot for the song for some reason. And I just decided to throw it on there because I just needed, you know, it seemed like it had the right heart or something to be, it should be on the record. So I included it.
Great track. A lot of nice variation on among the small square stuff, I think more so than I was hearing on some of the Velvet Crush albums, maybe because it wasn't like, here's a band image that we're presenting. It's just this, whatever you happen to be. So more minor key stuff, some more different arrangements. Anything else on the horizon? I know you just released a thing. Anything you want to announce? What are you working on at this point?
Well, still kind of promoting the Ours and Others record, but yeah, I got some other stuff that's in the can and working on more of it. I guess just with, you know, thoughts of doing another one in a little while, getting it together. I got maybe 4, 5, 6 songs thus far that I think I could work on. More writing.
All right. Well, excited to hear it. Good luck with the current record. So great talking to you.
Well, thank you for having me on your fabulous show, and I hope to come back again someday.
Here is SML, Save My Life.
Will you walk with me off into the heather? Can I stay with you on your mountainside? Could you save my life?
Thanks so much to Paul. I hope you like his songs as much as I did. You can learn about the current band at smallsquaremusic.com. You can get all of the Velvet Crush albums that they have the rights to, including the Choo Choo Train stuff and even a Rick Menk solo album at actionmusic.bandcamp.com, music there spelled with a K. You can see Paul playing live with Matthew Sweet touring right now. I'm going to be seeing him this week in Madison, Wisconsin. Look for me if you happen to be there. My next interview will be with Lynn Drury, an excellent New Orleans singer-songwriter. But first, I have a music topical discussion with three past guests. That's David Christian from Comet Gain, Roger Joseph Manning Jr. from Jellyfish and the Licorice Quartet, and Rachel Taylor Brown. So a little change of pace, but you will hear some new music from the folks among those who have new albums. Otherwise, it's kind of like the several music discussions I've posted in the past for my Pretty Much Pop a Culture podcast, though maybe a bit more unafraid to be music nerdy. I hope you're all doing well. Just to follow up on one of my previous announcements, my band did finish its new demo, but we might have a new member that we're going to overdub on some tracks, so it'll be delayed for probably another month while we see whether this is something we want to focus on. I'll let you know when you can hear it. Also, my dog died this week, which was a terrible bummer and is my excuse for being a bit late in this episode coming out. But such is the substance of this life that we like writing songs about. I have a song, Stupis in the Sky, about my last dog that died in 2011. I don't think I'll be doing the same here, though I did have a song about going for a walk with this dog that maybe this will get me to finish. In any case, I hope you are experiencing your life to the fullest, feeling things, being creative. Keep on musicking. Until next time, this is Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.